Israel's January 22nd election was predicted to safely reinstall Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party in coalition with Avigdor Lieberman's Yisrael Beiteinu party for another term in office. While opinion polls had projected that the ruling conservative coalition would win between 32 and 45 seats in the Israeli Knesset or parliament, when the votes were counted, they had won only 31. Two new parties emerged as beneficiaries from the erosion of public support for Netanyahu. Journalist-turned-politician Yair Lapid led his new centrist Yesh Atid, or There Is a Future party, to win 19 seats, in second place behind Netanyahu's coalition. Lapid's candidacy capitalized on growing resentment of government subsidies given to ultra-Orthodox Jews and Netanyahu's inaction on conforming to a Supreme Court order that mandates an end to military draft deferments for Orthodox men when they turn 18. While much of the world has focused concern on recent Israeli bombing attacks and incursions into the Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip and Netanyahu's expansion of Jewish settlements on Palestinian land, the issues of conflict and future peace talks with the Palestinians was hardly visible in the Israeli election campaign. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Menes, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Here she explains why she believes the results of the recent Israeli election provide little hope for the renewal of long-stalled Israeli-Palestinian peace talks.
Well, I think the best way to sort of see what happened with the Israeli elections would be to understand it as a victory for the status quo for Israel. This is a defeat for Bibi Netanyahu. He will continue to be the prime minister, almost certainly, but with far less political clout than he had going into this election. It was anticipated that his party, in its alliance with an even further right party, it's a two-party alliance, that they would come out with something like 42, 43 seats. In fact, they ended up with only 31, which is a significant decline. The other sort of surprise was the rise of this so-called centrist party, as you say, the Yesh Atid. What's interesting about that, Scott, is that how the discourse shifts in this country. We talk about it as a centrist party, that it was a center-left bloc, that the Israeli Knesset is now divided between the center-right and the center-left, when in fact the so-called center-left, or this centrist party in particular, which is a brand-new party led by a TV news anchor, they came out with 19 seats, the second biggest bloc in the whole Knesset. But their whole basis of existence was framed around issues of sort of social equality within the Israeli Jewish community only. So their big issue was a set of kind of what were considered sort of middle class issues around prices and that sort of thing. And most importantly, the question of sharing the burden of the military in a more equitable way, specifically the call to include in the otherwise universal draft of Israeli Jews, the ultra-Orthodox, who since the founding of the State of Israel have been exempt from the draft on the theory that they would protect the nation by spending their lives studying the Torah. And there finally started to be a kind of pushback against that by secular Jews, who are obviously a major component within the Jewish community in Israel, who said, that's not fair, we're taking all the risks, they sit around studying all day, that's not fair. So the big question now is limited to this question of, well, what's going to happen with the new coalition? Will Bibi Netanyahu's coalition of his party and the ultra-right party of his former foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, the Israel is my home party it's called, will that party, which includes in it a lot of ultra-Orthodox forces, will they be able to form a grand coalition with this new centrist party that is so much, in their view, opposed to the ultra-Orthodox by daring to suggest that they should play their part in the military. Now, the irony of all of this, Scott, is that none of this signals any change in the far-right position of the Israeli government that's been true for so long through labor governments and Likud governments and coalition governments of oppression of the Palestinians, settlement expansion, the siege of Gaza, none of that was on the agenda. The differences they may have, none of that played out in the election.
Phyllis, When you look at President Obama's second term in office, is there any indication that his administration will pursue more aggressively in the next 4 years what they didn't in the first 4 years, and that is to push Israel and Bibi Netanyahu to not be as much an obstacle towards renewing peace talks?
I mean, certainly this is a situation where the president could dramatically change his posture vis-a-vis Israel, could dramatically move to take seriously what President Obama was accused of doing falsely back in 2010. You remember in that second year of his first administration, when that summer there was, you know, a great heightened tension between Netanyahu and Obama, and there was all this talk and lots of press about, oh my God, this is getting very bad. Obama is turning out to be anti-Israel. Obama is pressuring Israel. Obama is throwing Israel under the bus. Well, in fact, there was no bus. In fact, there was no pressure. There were a series of requests, which were rather unusual. It didn't happen too often, that a U.S. president requested of the Israeli prime minister, please stop expanding illegal settlements. The answer from the Israelis, no. The request was repeated, please stop building settlements. No. And then the request stopped. That was the end of that. Real pressure would have looked very different. Real pressure would have looked like a demand from the Obama administration, stop building settlements, they're illegal. The Israelis say, no. And the answer is immediately, okay, you're an independent country, you can do what you want, but you know that $30 billion of our U.S. tax money that we have pledged to give directly to your military over these 10 years? You can kiss that goodbye. And you know how we've been protecting you in the United Nations? So that no Israeli military or political official is ever held accountable for violations of international law and potential war crimes, we're not doing that anymore. That's what pressure looks like. And we didn't see any of that.
That was Phyllis Spennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Find more news and analysis on the Israeli election and the Palestinian nonviolent resistance movement on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.